dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WEBR Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. And on the Commons with me today is an old friend, Don Shellhart. Don sent me an email a few weeks, months ago now, saying, guess what, Sue? I'm actually getting paid to fight homeowners associations. Now, how lucky can that be? Welcome, Don Shellhart. Thank you for joining us today. How are
nice
you?
Nice to be here, Sue.
Well, it's nice to have you here, and it's nice to know that someone's actually getting paid.
Well, I'm not getting paid a lot, but
listen,
I am getting paid.
It's not a drain like with me. I'm paying to do this, so you're doing better than I am. Don, before we get started, you've got a whole lot to tell us. Before we get started, can I get on my soapbox for just a minute? Do you mind?
Sure, no.
I want to tell you about my daughter. They bought a new house, and she called me a couple of days ago all excited because she happened to look out, and her next-door neighbor's house was on fire. And
Whoa.
The fire started outside. They're not sure what started it, whether it was one of the workers who chucked a lit cigarette into the mulch or whether it was an electrical fire. We don't know. She grabbed the phone, called 911. I mean, it had just started. And she called 911, and the fire department was there within minutes. And they put it out. There were two observations that she made. Number one was that the siding just melted. It's this new vinyl siding. And number two is the firefighters came over to her house and told her and thanked her for calling because the people were home. They were not aware that their house was burning. And he said within 10 minutes, the house would have been gone if they hadn't been there. It would have and this is a big house. Here's the way we're constructing houses nowadays. Flimsy little sticks, okay?
Yeah.
With cardboard and paint on the inside. We have stuffing in between, and on the outside, we have paper and plastic. And that's what consumers are paying hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for. These houses are being put in homeowner associations where local municipal governments are washing their hands of everything. I don't know why we've approved this form of construction. But if you live in a new house, if you have got new vinyl siding, beware because it just apparently melts. And, I never thought about this. It never dawned on me. But there you have it. How about that, Don?
Well, actually, it was reminding me of a time a couple of years ago when I lived in the Denver area. In Golden, Colorado, and also in the city of Denver at one point. And as has been happening more and more frequently out west with the long-term drought, they had wildfires all over the place. And there were some fire chiefs being interviewed on the local television just cussing up a storm, basically, about the construction of the new planned community developments. They said... first of all, the materials in the houses are such that they go up very quickly, and second of all, the homes are so close together that it's just about impossible to build any kind of fire break, and it just go, it's like a row of dominoes. So they were saying that it's a nightmare to protect a lot of these very high-density planned communities from a serious fire.
Well, I seem to remember where associations were running around spending their time and resources making sure that the homeowners complied and pulled their weeds and had nice houses and lived according to standards. However, the common areas were allowed to naturalize, and that meant a lot of dead wood sitting around, and with the houses being as close as they were, you know, they were going up, and that was the problem. And I know that some fire departments had come in and basically fined the association, making them clean up their act. So, but I just wanted to mention that. It's not something that I thought about until I heard about it, she said, Mom, you wouldn't believe it. She said, it's amazing how quickly the siding just melted. And it was a small fire. But the whole thing, you can see right into their house. Anyway, one more quick thing before we get on. A friend of mine lost her daughter a month before her 44th birthday to ovarian cancer. And there's a walk, a 5K walk run, and ovarian cancer is, they call it the whispering disease because the signs and symptoms whisper to you and you have to listen to figure out that you have it. There's no test that can be done. So on Saturday, June 12th, I will be doing a rebroadcast because I will be in Reston, and I will be doing the Whisper Walk for ovarian cancer awareness. The entry fee is $25. And if you live in Northern Virginia, I strongly urge you to join us. It will be, I think there's something on our thing. So please check it out, and please plan on coming. That's June 12th. The walk starts at 10 a.m. Registration's at 8:30. It's going to cost $25. Every penny of that will go towards, making people aware of what to look for. It's the Whisper Walk, so plan on being there, please. And if you can't be there, plan on sending in a donation. I know that they can use it. But so, Don, thank you for allowing me to take up some of your time.
But my pleasure.
I felt it was important to do this. Now, you're getting paid to fight associations. Tell us about it, Don. Tell us about it.
Okay. Well, I've been hired on a part-time basis by a group known as the National Antenna Consortium. And I'll give my first of several mentions to its website, www.antenna-consortium.org. NAC is basically composed of people who, I got to remember the right litany here, own, use, or build radio antennas and or own, lease, or build communications towers. Right now we have many more individual members than company members, so our focus tends to be on amateur radio operators and some of the restrictions that they face in homeowners associations. Our number one priority at the moment is getting legislative action to enact a bill called H.R. 1478. That's H.R. 1478. It was introduced in 2003 by Representative Stephen Israel, a Democrat from New York, and at the moment it has 34 co-sponsors. It's it needs more to get going, and we also need to find a senator to introduce a companion bill in the other House of Congress. This sounds like a good time to stop for a pause for a minute and see if you have anything to inject at this point, and then I can go on and tell you a little more about what the bill does.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what exactly does the bill do? You know, what would it do? How would it affect people who live in homeowner associations and who might want to put one up? And why would people in an association be allowed to have an antenna? Don't you know, Don, that they they tend to lower property values? I'm laughing, by the way. That's a sarcastic question.
I don't really think that the kind of antennas our people want to put up would really have much of an impact on property values. But
I don't think any antennas would, you know.
Yeah. But right now, most homeowners associations, not all, but most homeowners associations, and in addition, some restrictive covenants that apply outside of the world of HOAs, specifically prohibit any kind of externally visible antenna. We've even heard a few that prohibit even interior antennas, although I have no idea why. But anyway, the main argument against them appears to be aesthetic. And here's where I want to make a very important point. Most of the people in NAC would not argue for an absolutely unrestricted right to put up an antenna. I mean, if an HOA wants to limit the height of the antenna to 50 feet or something like that, I think most NAC people would, you know, accept that as a reasonable compromise. Not all, but most. But in general, these HOAs are just banning them completely, just flat out. And what this bill would do would direct the Federal Communications Commission to use legal authority it already has in order to require HOAs to make quote-unquote reasonable accommodation with amateur radio service antennas. And this is very important from a public safety standpoint. Your timing in mentioning your daughter's experience with her housing development is very appropriate. Traditionally, amateur radio operators, aka hams, have been the first people to get information in and out of disaster areas. And what the HOAs are doing when they ban all antennas, and again, we're not arguing about reasonable regulation, we're talking about total prohibitions of any antennas used by hams. What happens when HOAs do that is that they, in effect, cut their community out of the emergency communications grid, or at least out of an important part of the emergency communications grid. And so in the event of a disaster, news that would otherwise be flowing in and out of their neighborhood, information about what's on fire, where, et cetera, when the normal communications infrastructure is down, information that would normally be flowing in and out of those neighborhoods is going to be precluded. And in a large disaster, that's going to cost lives. And it's really a public safety issue.
You're on the Commons, and we're talking to Don Schellhardt. He is a lobbyist for the National Antenna Consortium, and he is lobbying to exempt any prohibitions on reasonable antennas. Don, thanks for mentioning the emergency situation. I mean, the fire, the phones worked very well during the other day when the fire occurred, and so Tammy was able to grab the phone and call 911, and she got through immediately, so that was not a problem. However, if you lived in New York or Washington on 911 a few years ago, nothing worked. The phones were down, cell phones were jammed, and it was very, very important then to be able to get information out. And the only way we could was through hams, but guess what? They weren't allowed to operate because they didn't have antennas. Because everything around here is in an HOA, for goodness sakes.
Well, I want to mention that there are other benefits to ham radio besides just the emergency communications capability. And I want to mention those other advantages quickly and then get back to the emergencies. which okay. I think is the most compelling case. But traditionally, ham radio, or people involved with ham radio, have been responsible for technical innovations. So there's been a contribution to the intellectual property reserve of the country, if you want to put it in economic terms. Another advantage, which is sort of along the same lines, is that a lot of people in broadcast communications and more broadly in the sciences in general got acquainted with the world of radio or the world of science through ham radio. Sometimes it started with, even before ham radio, with little crystal radio sets, but often the ham radio training was a rite of passage into broadcast-oriented professions. I was recently speaking at a national conference of the Society of Broadcast Engineers, a meeting near Boston. And at one point, a different speaker asked how many people in the audience were hams as well as professional broadcast engineers. And more than 90% of the hands in the audience went up. And it became very clear to me that almost all broadcast engineers in the country began in ham radio. And, you know, to a lesser extent, you can look at other fields, even non-radio fields like, you know, astronomy or computers, and you often find that the individual involved had their first taste of things technological by becoming a ham, usually at a fairly young age. Now we're walling off a good chunk of an entire generation from having that experience, and as a result, we are probably going to end up with fewer high-quality scientists and engineers in the future, because the future is beginning now. And at a time when we're trying very, very hard to compete with the rest of the world economically, it's sort of crazy to cut off this source of training, self-financed training, for the next generation of scientists and engineers. Anyway, those are other advantages. In addition to just the fact that it's fun and builds community for people with introverted temperaments, it's often a way that they can learn to socialize with other people in a less threatening environment with a little built-in distance, literally. So there are other social benefits too. But I think at this particular time in our history, the single most important value of the amateur radio service is its ability to provide emergency communications. And that's what we're stressing. If your community bans all amateur radio antennas, it is pulling itself out of the emergency communications network. And I don't know whether the HOAs don't realize that or whether they realize that but don't care, but there is a very tangible price that people living in those communities may have to pay, because no one in the community is going to be in a position to convey or receive information in the event of a disaster.
In terms of whether or not associations care, I just don't understand this, because there are a lot of things that associations do that are counter what's good for the nation and what's good for the homeowners in associations. Things like when there are droughts, they insist on people watering their lawns, regardless of whether there's enough water to drink or not. You know, their lawns have got to be in good shape. You have associations that insist on using wood shake roofs, and we were talking about fires earlier, and they're very prone to fires. And even though you have new construction, new material that is not as combustible and looks exactly like wood shakes, then they don't allow them to be there because, you know, you have to have wood shakes. I mean, that's all there is to it. So, you know, the fact that people are not allowed to have antennas and might contribute to sort of not allowing the free flow of information. I don't think they care, Don. I just don't understand it.
Well, I think a part of the problem is that in some cases, many cases from what I gather, the starting point for HOA regulations is a set of guidelines developed by the developer and the bank that's providing the financing. So, you know, often it isn't even really the result of a majority vote by the homeowners. They sort of start off with these regulations, and then if they want to change anything with them, within them, there may or may not be some cumbersome procedures for amending them. But, you know, in a lot of cases, it's the bank worrying about getting a return on its investment and the developer worrying about, you know, getting a return on its investment, who are setting down these rules. And it's the nature of capitalism, you know, that companies are going to worry about their bottom line, but it's also the nature of a stable society that the bottom line of companies should be only one of the factors considered. I mean, the welfare of the people affected by this should also be considered, and that's left out of the process completely in many cases. I also should mention that Don Shellhart, as an individual, is in favor of all kinds of efforts to rein in the excessive authority of HOAs. However, Don Shellhart, Vice President for Government Relations at NAC, is focused in mainly on the antennas. You know, that's what our members care about. But I certainly want to say that there are many other areas where reform is needed, and some of the combustible materials you mentioned. Also, in a lot of cases, HOAs work against energy conservation. They won't allow people to dry their clothes on a clothesline. They
sometimes fight. Roller blinds.
Excuse me?
Put up roller blinds to be able to lower their air conditioning bills to prevent the sun from coming in the West. You know, it just everything is, oh, no, you can't do that.
Well, it's everything gets subordinated to somebody's arbitrary idea of what will increase property values, you know, and you know, the two problems with that are, first of all, property values aren't the only thing that's meaningful in life, and second, I think in a lot of cases, there are false assumptions about what kind of housing people are looking for. I know for sure that if you're looking for my, you know, house buying dollar, you're gonna have a lot better chance of getting me to buy if you don't have an HOA.
Well, we're hearing more and more of that. I mean, even people who went into the HOA thinking they'd be able to control their neighbors and that they would be able to preserve their property values, after a while are coming out of there going, never again. Even when they were on the board, they're saying, never again. I've heard of people saying they've been driving through neighborhoods and if everything looks pristine, they just back away because the downside of that is the quality of life. People who live in these things live of sheer terror of what their associations are going to do. I've had people say, I moved out because I spent all my time living with fear of what my associations would do. I've got people who are being abused by their associations, who are desperate, who are scared, who are, you know, they've just been terrorized. They've been abused. They've been terrorized. They're being dragged through kangaroo courts. They're being fined. They're being threatened. They're being called every name in the book. They're being vilified. It's just absolutely horrible. And more and more people are saying never again. Problem is that local municipal governments are saying, oh, yes, everything we have has got to be in an association because it gives them the ability to keep taxing you and not provide you with any services. The developers are gone. You know, they'll come in, they'll build these things, they'll put up these stupid associations because they're mandatory. They'll come up with hundreds and hundreds of pages of restrictions and prohibitions and conditions and all of that other wonderful stuff. But once they've sold, they've moved on. You know, they don't have a stake in it.
Well,
and the homeowners are the ones who are left there trying to figure out what to do with this mess.
Well, in the second half of our hour, I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, possible broadly based legislation to hold the HOAs more accountable in general.
What I'd like to do also when we come back during the second half is I would like you to give us some tips on how to lobby effectively, because that's something that homeowners don't seem to be able to get their hands around.
Okay. It might be worthwhile to mention here that I've spent almost 30 years of my life working with or for government in one capacity or another. So I know from lobbying.
That's why you're the one, my choice, to explain to us what we're going to be doing, you know, how to effectively lobby. Also, we do have a couple of emails. We could probably take one now and another one when we come back from break,
okay.
Because we'll be going to break.
I also want to make sure I mention a little bit about why I think the probability of natural and man-made disasters in the United States is on the rise, which kind of sets the stage for my concern that we're not doing enough to prepare.
We didn't even talk about natural disasters.
Yeah, and I want to introduce at some point, maybe in the second half, the concept of a mega disaster. We are used to dealing with disasters where, you know, something bad happens and emergency relief arrives within, say, 24 hours. But it's possible that we may be overdue for a much larger scale disaster, like the quote unquote the big one in Southern California, where it's possible that emergency relief could be delayed for weeks or even months in some places, making it vitally important to keep a communications lifeline open through the hams.
You know, that's an excellent point, Don. You know what? We're going to take a break now. It's a couple of minutes early, but we'll take
Oh, yeah, because I was looking at my watch, and I said, I got five more minutes.
we can take a break now, and when we come back, we have a fairly busy second half with a lot more information. So if you want to go and get a drink, that's fine. Go do so. But be back, because we'll be here in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to On the Commons with Don Shohart, and I'm Sue Bartholomew.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WEBR, Fairfax, Virginia. You're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and on the Commons with us is Don Shohart. Don is probably the only person in America today who is actually getting paid to fight association. So I'm really pleased to have Don on the show with us today. Maybe some of that will rub off. Don, as you know, this is a very small broadcasting outfit here, and unfortunately we only have one phone line. So what we do is we ask people to email us ahead of time if they have any questions for the guest. And I have a couple of these questions, a couple of emails, and I'd like to read them to you. and maybe get some input from you. And this one is from Nick, and it says, if a state or county requires that new developments have a mandatory homeowners association and restrictive covenants, don't those covenants become a governmental action that is controlled by the U.S. Constitution and by the FCC PRB1 preemption of governmental antenna bands? What's that, and what's the answer?
Oh, boy. Okay, well, all right. First of all, since this question is at least potentially a trial law question, I do want to mention that I have had some courtroom experience. I definitely prefer lobbying and regulatory advocacy, and I spent more than 20 years of my life on the lobbying end of things, including time as Director of Legislative and Regulatory Affairs for the American Gas Association. That's natural gas, not gasoline. But I also have spent some time in court, including work for the Blue Ridge Legal Services Corporation in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and also some private practice in family law, also in the Harrisonburg / Shenandoah Valley area. The reason it's important to mention that is to establish that, you know, I know from lobbying, and I also know from courts to a certain extent, therefore, I think I can say with some degree of authority that usually it's easier to lobby a bill than to get something through the courts. That's not always true. But I believe it's probably true here. In short, when Nick is talking about the government requirement to participate in HOAs making this a governmental action rather than a private sector action, I think he's absolutely correct.
In other words, state action exists and the Constitution prevails.
Yeah, well, that's how I would interpret it. However, I also think that from an activist standpoint, it is probably faster and cheaper to lobby Congress, or perhaps first the state legislature in selected states. It's probably easier to lobby legislators or get a ballot referendum through where that's allowed and so on than to go through the courts, because even though I think Nick is absolutely right here and I sort of made that argument myself, the courts are very resistant to this interpretation of the Constitution, and I think it would probably cost at least hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably millions of dollars, to try to actually win this in court, and it would also probably take you a number of years. Now, lobbying Congress or getting a ballot referendum on in a state or lobbying the state legislature isn't easy or cheap either, but I think that you can probably get where you want to go faster dealing with politicians than dealing with judges. And that's not advice I would give on every issue, but here's an issue where I think there's a huge potential pool of public support and a relatively small, though well-financed, group of people who are opposing change. And in that situation, I think you're probably going to get better results if you go to a forum where votes count rather than arguments in court.
Okay, let's get to this so that we've got quite a bit of stuff that we want to cover still. So let's go to the next email that we got as well. And I have to tell you, it's very closely related to this one. And it starts off with, it's so good of you to cover the subject of antennas and HOAs. I'd appreciate you exploring this issue with Don Shellhart of NAC. The question is, HOA rules often conflict with federal and state laws. In some cases, a person's constitutional rights are violated by an HOA's actions. Almost always, local courts side with the HOAs, claiming contracts supersede local or federal laws. How do we force the issue of a citizen's protection under the Constitution? I'm not sure that, you know, I think I take issue with the fact I don't think that you can have a contract that's illegal, but you can sign away your rights, and I think that's the way it's been explained to me, is that when you buy into an association, by buying into an association, you've agreed to give up certain protections.
Okay. First of all, in answering this question, I neglected to mention what the PRB 1 program is.
That's a
regulatory program run by the FCC. Just very briefly, it under this program, the FCC has the legal authority to preempt otherwise applicable antenna regulations. In other words, they can come in and say other provisions of law notwithstanding, you can't prevent antennas from going up. You can say you can set their reasonable height limit and aesthetic, you know, parameters and so on, but you cannot actually ban them. You have to make quote unquote reasonable accommodations. And under that program, the FCC does allow some degree of preemption of antenna regulations by state and local governments.
But that's not extended.
But it doesn't preempt HOAs. And in effect, what the Israel bill does, H.R. 1478, see antennaconsortium.org for details, what the Israel bill does is to essentially bring HOAs within the scope of the PRB 1 program so that they're treated as if they were state and local governments for purposes of these regulations. The FCC has the authority to do this on its own, but so far it has consistently refused to do so, so we have to go to Congress.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, anyway, in terms of the legal cases, you have concentric circles of vulnerability, if I can paint it that way, if you're going after HOA bans in court. Basically, the less choice the consumer has, the easier it is to argue that this choice should be that the government should step in to set limits on what the contract or the restrictive covenant can require. Now, I think the most vulnerable HOAs would be those in places where the state and local government actually requires all new housing developments to have HOAs, where by law there's no consumer choice, at least in much of the market. Fairfax County, Virginia, you know, where you are, is an example of a jurisdiction that does that. Anyway, I think there you can say this is government action. You know, this is a private,
Yeah,
so therefore it should be subject to the same constitutional restrictions that a government action would be. Then the next circle going out would be cases where there's no law, but there's a sort of standardized market practice. And this is what Fairfax County was like when I was living there 20 years ago, 15 years ago. Anyway, there wasn't a legal requirement to have HOAs, but all the banks required all the developers to have them. And the terms were fairly similar in important respects. And so there, it's not government action, but it's equivalent to companies violating the antitrust laws. There's a Uniform Commercial Code that's supposed to govern all business transactions, or almost all business transactions, in the 50 states, except Louisiana, which is under French law. Anyway, there's something called the Uniform Commercial Code, and it's been interpreted by the courts to prohibit what's called, quote-unquote, adhesion contracts. And that comes from a case where a consumer was suing over certain adverse terms in an auto loan contract. And the auto loan company said, well, he signed this contract, you know, he's got to live with it. And the court said, well, for everywhere in northern New Jersey, everyone going for an auto loan has to have a standardized contract. All the contracts have the same term. So therefore, it's not really a case of free consumer choice. And in that case, the UCC struck down the contract clause and allowed the consumer to proceed. And I think you could argue the same thing with respect to HOAs in areas where requirements of law or not, the market practice is totally standardized. And then I think we, in areas where people have a choice on what they do, which are fairly few these days, you know, where there's genuinely HOA housing competing with non-HOA housing, then I think it becomes harder to make a court-based case. But even there, I think you might have, you know, some merit. But certainly in a lot of our metropolitan areas, including not just metropolitan, including the whole state of Colorado, there's a legal requirement for HOAs. And in other areas, it's effective. It might as well be a legal requirement because all the banks require all the developers to impose HOA restrictions. And so in those cases, at least, I think you could make a great case in court, at least on paper, for rolling back the HOA authorities. The problem is that courts are very resistant to change. And once you get into a court contest, the side with the most money has a very clear advantage. Now, when you go over into lobbying, the side with the most money also has a clear advantage, but if you have enough people on your side, you can override the special interest advantage. Whereas it's very hard to override the special interest advantage in a courtroom situation. If you're fighting, you know, I don't know, Bank of America, in effect, you know, your local developer whose plan was imposed by Bank of America, you know, they can make you spend $200,000-$300,000 just on producing documents for the case before you even pay your lawyer a dime to actually do any work. You know, they can drown you in paperwork requirements.
It's economic warfare.
Yes, and you know, this is one of the reasons I don't like courtroom law, and you know, I went back to lobbying after a, you know, 5-year flirtation with the courtroom. Courtrooms are terribly unjust in many cases. And so is the political system, but generally if you've got numbers, you have a better chance with the politicians than you do with the judges. With the politicians, you can make it votes versus dollars. With the courts, it's dollars. It's in effect, it's dollars as the only currency. And what really burns my butt is just, pardon the expression, is that one side can just require so much paperwork that they can flatten the other side without ever getting the merits of the case. That burns me up. But anyway, that's a topic for another day.
We're running, and we've got about 10 minutes, and we still need to talk about disasters and mega disasters, and you were going to give us some tips on, you sort of flirted with talking about lobbying, but you were going to give us some actual tips on how to do that effectively. So you've got.
I'm going to have to proceed fairly rapid fire here to cover everything. Okay.
Time flies, doesn't it, when you're having fun, Don?
Well, I really think I'm doing the Lord's work here. I mean, I am getting paid a little bit for this. I'd love to see NAAC get more members so I can be paid more. But it's also a passion with me because I think I'm helping to save lives. I honestly do. I think if the Israel bill can become law, and perhaps beyond it, other legislation, but certainly the Israel bill, I think it will save lives, potentially thousands or tens of thousands of lives if you're talking about a mega disaster. And I mean, I believe that. And I wish I could get more people to give me more money so I can contact more congressmen and senators and get them to pass this bill. With disasters and mega disasters, our concept of a disaster in this country in modern history is usually one where you know, even like 9/11, bad as it was, you know, the communications are down for 24 hours or whatever. I know I was living in Connecticut when 9/11 occurred, and the New York TV stations actually went off the air for about 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the relief comes in immediately. It's still sort of, sort of manageable in scale in the sense that the rest of the country is there to step in.
Yeah.
Now, even in that case, hams can save lives, because in disaster after disaster, it's been shown that they are often the first on the air to get information in and out, and frequently the only people on the air for crucial hours or more, you know, maybe even days. I think in the United States it's usually only for hours, like in Hurricane Andrew, but like in Chernobyl, the first word of Chernobyl to hit the world press came through a ham. And they were relaying information to the Red Cross and other people about who needed what help where, while the Russian government was still fumbling over what to do. So, I mean, Chernobyl sort of begins to approach a mega disaster. But anyway, that's the conventional idea of a disaster, and even 9/11 fits into that. The rest of the country is there, ready to help almost immediately. Okay, now my concept of a mega disaster, and such things do happen, is one where there's so much destruction of or disruption of infrastructure that communications, transportation, and so on in the affected region may be down for weeks or months. And the affected region is so large, I once proposed the definition of the FCC that, you know, you talk about a disaster area that's at least 10,000 square miles in area, which is about the size of New Jersey. Now, that may seem like a lot of territory, but that's because we haven't had a major earthquake in a populated area in this, you know, in the last 100-some-odd years. But an 8.5 earthquake in Los Angeles would probably be a mega disaster. It would probably knock out communications and transportation for 10,000 square miles or more. And the other half of the definition would be that even though the mega disaster area itself is totally or mostly disrupted, the rest of the country is sufficiently affected that the flow of relief supplies is delayed for weeks or more. And, you know, I think that could happen. On the natural side, you see, you know, there's the big one in Southern California, but also there's the fact that some areas of the country have major earthquakes very infrequently, you know, only one every two or three centuries. But when they happen, they're very big. The largest earthquake ever to hit the United States was not in California. It was in Charleston, South Carolina. It was probably, they estimated it was about an 11 on the Richter scale. Just fantastic size. It happened back in the 1770s, and it killed some people. But, you know, at the time, there probably weren't even a million people living in the whole area affected by the earthquake. You know, today it would probably affect people from Jacksonville up to Norfolk and inland to Atlanta and Nashville. So, you know, that could happen, and geologically we're overdue for a quake of that size. Another example in the natural world would be Mount Rainier. Geologically, it's very similar to Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens went up with the impact of a hydrogen bomb, and, you know, it pretty much devastated everything within 20 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, it was very remote, so only a few people were killed. But Mount Rainier is geologically similar, and if you have a 20-mile destruction zone coming out from Mount Rainier, you're hitting some of the suburbs of Seattle and Tacoma. So anyway, on the natural, you know, disaster, in terms of the natural world,
mm-hmm.
we are positioned for a mega disaster. And then, of course, there are terrorist nuclear weapons, or the possibility of terrorist nuclear weapons. And if they go beyond a suitcase bomb and actually, say, purchase an advanced thermonuclear weapon from the Russian mafia, say, you could have a nuclear explosion that would just pretty much flatten everything, say, from the Capitol building to the Beltway, and cause a great deal of fire and fallout way beyond that. And with a nuclear explosion, it's thermonuclear, especially hydrogen bombs. It's hams can be particularly important because you've got three things to worry about. There's a blast effect, a heat effect, and radioactive fallout. The blast effect is probably limited to within, say, 10 miles. I mean, sort of, most of the people who die from the blast effect would be within, say, 10 or 12 miles of ground zero. But then beyond that, the heat effect goes much further.
I didn't mean to
get off into the details, but the point is there are areas where people are still alive, the infrastructure is still left intact, but there is danger to be dealt with.
And they need to be rescued.
And could be vital in getting information out. Like, you know, fallout is headed your way. Things like that. How much time do I have left for actual lobbying?
About 4 minutes.
Oh, God.
Go on. All right.
First of all, do check with the website at www.antenna-consortium.org. Sure, you'll be putting up a link there. I will be posting information on the membership of key committees in Congress and
lobbying done.
Yeah. But anyway, first thing is, try to find out. This will be on my website, but you can also find out by going to the www.house.gov or www.senate.gov. Find out and see if your senator or representative is on one of the key committees. In this case, it would be the House Energy and Commerce Committee or the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee.
Okay, for HOAs, what would the committee be?
Okay, for this bill, it would be those two, House Energy and Commerce Committee.
Okay, but for associations in general, governmental affairs?
I would say for broader HOA reform, where there isn't a bill yet, that would probably go before the House and Senate Judiciary Committee. But right now, nobody's introduced a bill, so there's nothing to ask them to do.
Okay.
And that's something I'll be putting up a posting about that, too. I've tried for a number of years to see if people would be interested in a bill that would say essentially anything that's unconstitutional if done by an arm of government should be illegal if done by an HOA. I haven't had much support for something that broad. Everybody out there wants to focus on their piece of the problem.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I'm going to post the text of a proposed bill, and if there's enough support for it, I'll go lobby for it. But we are talking money here. It's not a cheap enterprise to lobby a bill. But in terms of the bill that's on out there now, the HOA antenna bill, you want to look and see if your member of Congress is on the House Energy and Commerce Committee or the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee. I can tell you that one of the key senators on the latter committee is George Allen from Virginia. So that's a good place to start lobbying right there. If with the H.R. 1478, tell your congressman or congresswomen that you want to have House hearings on the bill and you want them to co-sponsor the bill if they haven't already co-sponsored it. That's H.R. 1478. With the senators, it's more wide open. We need senators to sponsor a companion bill in the Senate. There's no Senate bill that's comparable to H.R. 1478. We need to have senators introducing their bill so we can get things started in that body. And again, George Allen is on the
Don, we're out of time. Don, we're out of time. Thank you so much for taking time out from your busy schedule to join us. It's always a pleasure to have you here. And I want to remind everyone, if you live in Virginia, please mark June 12th for the Whisper Walk in Reston, and you'll be getting more information about that. We're now webcasting live. Go to fcac.org, click on WEBR, and follow the bouncing ball. And you can tune in on the Internet and get us live. Of course, the show is still on the Commons. It's still on thecommons.com. Check us out. And thanks for hanging out with us today on the Commons. Please join. On the Commons is produced by Multimedia Productions. Thanks for joining us. See y'all next week. Stay tuned and stay free. Bye.